Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I'm delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Charles Komanoff. He is an activist, an economist, and a policy analyst. He is the director of the Carbon Tax Center. The website is carbontax.org. He develops traffic pricing modeling tools for the Nurture Nature Foundation. His work includes books such as Power Plant Cost Escalation, Killed by Automobile, and The Bicycle Blueprint. Charles Komanoff, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Hey, David, how are you?
I'm good. What is the Carbon Tax Center?
Well, it's a small nonprofit in its seventh year that helps citizens around the country advocate effectively for a U.S. carbon tax as the most effective and equitable way of reducing emissions of carbon dioxide that are destabilizing the climate.
There's a great section on the website, carbontax.org, that goes through a number of myths as an effort to explain why a carbon tax. I don't know if we have time or if you have the energy for all of them, because there are quite a lot of myths, but things like new taxes on carbon emissions or energy are unfair to the poor and middle class, or carbon taxes won't actually change our habits. Higher gasoline prices didn't change our habits. Can you summarize some of those arguments for us?
You know, you've raised two important issues. And the first is the idea that households and businesses and institutions don't respond to price incentives. And, you know, there's a whole world out there that disproves that. I mean, look at taxes on cigarettes, which even more than bans or restrictions on smoking in restaurants or buildings have, over the past several decades, moved the U.S. population from being majority smokers to small minority smokers. And, you know, with energy, there's this tendency to think that every use of energy, every way in which houses are heated, buildings are lit, people get around, is impervious to price changes. And yet, everything can be made more energy efficient, and culture can change as well. Price is a huge determinant of how individuals and institutions react to energy, both on a day-to-day basis and on a 50-year horizon, let's say, with product development or building location. And as I said, there's a whole world of evidence that demonstrates that if we make energy more expensive, then people and businesses will organize themselves to use less of it. And that is more than any other response, or I should say that, along with the development of renewable energy like wind and solar, is how the United States and other countries are finally going to be able to get the fossil fuel monkey off our back and the climate monkey off our back. We now go to the second concern, which is, can we raise energy prices without slamming the poor? You know, and at this point, the poor is not the bottom 20%. It's, become kind of the bottom 80% of American society, with more and more of the income and wealth being accumulated at the top. So ultimately, it's a question of politics and how the carbon tax revenues are distributed or recycled, which is a political question. That's going to determine whether poor people get screwed by, you know, yet another government policy, or whether the poor and the middle class together can break even or even come out ahead under a carbon tax. And there are any number of mechanisms: tax shift, monthly so-called dividend checks. If we have time, we can go into detail on that, but people can go to carbontax.org and see how that could work in theory, and how it's working very well in the one jurisdiction in North America that has a robust carbon tax, and that is British Columbia on the west coast of Canada, which is now in the sixth year of a carbon tax, and its economy is humming, jobs are reasonably plentiful, and British Columbia alone, among all the provinces of Canada, has considerably reduced its CO2 emissions, and that's just in half a dozen years of a fairly modest carbon tax. So carbon taxes work, they can be equitable, and it's really time to build a citizens' movement here that's going to establish carbon taxing at the center of U.S. climate policy.
Well, I'm convinced, and I couldn't agree more. I wondered, though, on the cigarettes example, just to go back to that briefly, hasn't there been a great deal of education? Hasn't there been some truth in labeling? Aren't there a number of factors to try to separate out in looking at decline in cigarette use?
Absolutely. So this is not to represent a carbon tax as the only policy that is effective and the only policy that's needed. Rather, it's to say that without a carbon tax, we will be fighting probably an impossibly uphill battle to get carbon dioxide emissions under control, because fossil fuels, as they are dug out of the ground and burned in furnaces, engines, and power plants, are so cheap, you know, not cheap to society and not cheap to human health and not cheap to the climate, but they're so cheap in their extraction that it's hard for any alternative, whether it's energy efficiency or bicycling or renewable energy like wind and solar, to compete unless we saddle the prices of fossil fuels, coal, oil, and gas, with something resembling their true cost. And to bring it back to, you know, to the cigarettes question, even if we had bans, even if we had all the education in the world, if people, especially teenagers, could walk into a convenience store and buy a pack of Camels for a buck, there would be far more cigarette smoking than there actually is. So of all the measures, including education, the taxation of cigarettes for a social purpose of reducing and discouraging cigarette use has been the most effective. And the same is going to apply with carbon.
Cheap as carbon may be to extract, never mind the other costs and results, isn't it beyond that? Isn't the U.S. federal government at this point, through tax breaks and other means, effectively subsidizing fossil fuel extraction so that the playing field isn't even level?
You're absolutely right, David. And yet, you know, while anybody who is involved in energy policy who's not in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry, and unfortunately, you know, that's not necessarily a total majority, because the lobbying by the fossil fuel corporations is pervasive and intense and very effective. But even if we could eliminate all those tax breaks, you know, the low resource extraction fees, the oil depletion allowance, the accelerated depreciation for new nuclear plants, et cetera, that is only going to have a modest extent or impact of leveling the playing field. The real subsidy, if you will, is the failure to internalize the health cost, the societal cost, and the climate cost of fossil fuels within their prices. So it's kind of like eliminating the subsidies would barely get us to first base. We need the carbon tax to get us to second, third, and then home plate in terms of aligning the economics of energy in a way that can provide for a future for our planet.
We're speaking with Charles Komanoff from the Carbon Tax Center, carbontax.org. I called you up, Charles, because of a post I saw on carbontax.org about Germany and what Germany is doing and how the U.S. media and presumably the U.S. government are ignoring what Germany is doing. Can you fill people in?
I'm really kind of excited about what I've been learning about Germany, and maybe I'm a bit of a latecomer to what Germany has been doing over the past several decades, but it's gathering steam. It finally came within my radar, and what Germany is doing through a coordinated, synergistic set of policies is transitioning off of fossil fuels to renewable power from wind, water, sunlight, you know, biological fuels. And they are now at the point where, even excluding hydroelectricity, you know, which is the kind of traditional renewable power, if you will, one-fifth, a little bit more than 20% of Germany's electricity production last year came from renewable sources. Let's sort of see what the numbers are. And this post, which you can find, you know, on the carbon tax.org website that David cited, has got a a table that's kind of pretty comprehensive on this, that last year, out of all the electricity produced in Germany, and by the way, they produced more than they needed, they exported electricity to their neighbors, especially the Netherlands, 8.4% was from wind. That's double the 4.1% that was wind's share in the United States last year. 6.7% from biomass, you know, wood waste and plants, versus 1% in the U.S. Most impressively, 4.7% from photovoltaic cells, you know, those high-tech solar cells that can be put on, you know, houses, commercial buildings, any sort of structure. Almost 1/20th of German electricity last year came from PV, photovoltaics, whereas in the United States, it was 1/5 of 1%, that's 0.2%. To put it another way, and taking into account that Germany has only 1/27th as much land area as the United States, you know, it's not a huge country, you know, that per unit of land area, Germany is now generating almost 100 times as much solar electricity as the U.S. Per unit of land area, Germany is now generating nearly 10 times as much wind power as the U.S. And Germany is doing this with no drag or no apparent drag on its economy. You know, since the financial collapse of half a dozen years ago, Germany has added more jobs than the United States and certainly more than any other country in Europe. It has added more production and output than any other country in Europe and around the same as the United States. Germany has a very solid economy, and exports are booming in Germany. And so the hand-wringing that you see in the New York Times and other publications about this Germany energy transition is really pretty bizarre, and that's what my new post focuses on.
What do you mean by hand-wringing?
Germany has a special name for its energy makeover. They call it's in German, it's the Energiewende. And if you put that, if you can spell it, and if you put go to the New York Times website and type Energiewende, and you can see the spelling in the my new post on carbontax.org. Here's what you'll see in the five most recent headlines of New York Times coverage of this energy transition going back over the past 18 months. In the most recent post, and these are the headlines, the word problems. Before that, resistance. The previous article in the Times, warning. Just before that, complex. And the article before that, challenge. You know, all of these are words warning of difficulty. I think hand-wringing is a fair term for that. And David, it is bizarre because the Times, you know, supposedly evinces an ecological posture, a concern over climate damage, a desire to have sustainability in the world. And what do they do in their coverage of the one society, the one industrial economy, Germany's, that is actually doing what the climate crisis requires? You know, they wring their hands and focus on the problems instead of on the progress and the upside.
Well, the New York Times favors peace on Earth and can never get enough wars. I mean, I don't think we'll ever, as a species, manage to explain the behavior of the New York Times. But but I think a friend of mine, Harvey Wasserman, who has a book called Solartopia and who's talked about it on this.
I know Harvey and his book. They're both great.
Yeah, well, he's been on this show, and he, of course, sees developments like Germany's and elsewhere advancing dramatically and exponentially and resulting in a green energy utopia, whereas it's very common to hear from others the argument that it's just not feasible, it's not possible, it's not, you can't do it, there's not enough. Advocates for fossil fuels and advocates for nuclear will just tell you it can't be done. So what do you think are the prospects for Germany to continue this trend? Have they reached any kind of plateau that they can't surpass?
You know, if there is a plateau, it's political. You know, there, from what I see, and I don't pass myself off as a close follower of you know, German politics. You know, there's pushback there, but it is not even remotely on the level of the pushback in the United States when anyone proposes a solar-based policy, and by solar I mean, you know, renewable, including wind, etc., or when folks like me propose a carbon tax as a way of improving the incentives disseminating throughout the entire economy the economic incentives that can speed this transition away from fossil fuels. And so I'm sanguine that Germany is continuing on this path, and the polls that I've come across suggest that as much as 85% of the German people support this Energiewende, or energy makeover, or transition. And, you know, it's not an overnight thing. This energy change is rooted in a very strong ecological movement, an anti-nuclear movement that goes back to the 70s and was reinforced by Chernobyl in 1986, and then, of course, intensified 3 years ago by the Fukushima catastrophe. There's a strong ecological attachment to the land and water and air that is resisting fracking in Germany. So I think we can be optimistic that Germany is going to continue on its renewable energy program.
And if it does, and if other countries do, and if they develop to 10 times where Germany is now, will it be possible for the general public in the United States to be kept completely ignorant of that fact? Will the debates and discussions go on just as they are now, as if that isn't happening?
Yeah, you know, at some point, you kind of hope that the fact will overtake, you know, the veil of propaganda, you know, which may be starting to happen with the Affordable Care Act, with the, you know, the accumulating signups of formerly uninsured Americans and the leveling off of health care costs. It is becoming harder, I think, for Fox News and the right wing to, you know, maintain the myths against the Affordable Care Act. On a more local level here in my own New York City, where I'm one of a whole community of people who advocate for bicycling and walking infrastructure here, the drumbeat of criticism and the pushback that lasted for decades against making bicycling better, safer, and easier through provision of infrastructure like bike lanes, and now the bike share program here in New York City, that too has begun to recede as over the past decade or so, there's been at least a tripling in the amount of cycling, with no real increase in cycling injuries despite this tripling, and a growing accommodation and rapprochement, if you will, between cyclists and pedestrians who previously were kind of put at war against each other by the automobile interests and the tabloid press. So at some point, the facts will win out. One does despair somewhat, though, that the United States is going to be left behind in this revolution and is going to lose a good deal of its competitiveness, and at the same time that carbon dioxide is going to continue accumulating in the atmosphere at higher rates than it would if we and other countries were proceeding along the renewable energy transition at the rate that Germany is.
Isn't the risk somewhat greater than a competition among nations? Isn't the risk to the livability of the planet?
Well, yes, which is why this transition has to be made as quickly as possible. And, you know, your question points to yet another irony in the blinkered coverage of the German energy makeover in the New York Times and other media, which is that the aggressive pursuit of wind turbines and solar photovoltaic electricity in Germany has succeeded in reducing the costs of wind and solar power, as volume purchases have allowed mass production and the emergence of economies of scale that are driving wind and solar further along their technological development curves and technology learning curves, so that Germany, you could say, is performing a dual service to the world. A, it is showing that you can cap and reduce carbon emissions without having to increase nuclear power, by the way, through intensive and purposeful deployment of renewables. And second, it is bringing down the costs of this renewable alternative for everyone in the world. So if ever a national industrial policy by any nation on earth deserves applause, it is right now with the German energy transition. And we really need to get the facts out and end this hand-wringing and convert the stance of the media here in the United States to hand-clapping over what Germany is doing for itself and for the world.
That would be great to see. It's rare for the United States to clap hands for another country and lead, even offering it a great gift. But I have a question sort of about environmental policy from the perspective of a peace advocate, of an opponent of our military policy. Various people rank the U.S. military somewhere around 30th, if it were a nation, just the U.S. military, in carbon use. That is to say, we don't just fight wars over fossil fuels. The wars themselves consume a huge amount of the fossil fuels to fight the wars, and it's not clear which is the chicken and the egg there. The obsession with the Middle East was to fuel the British Navy. That came first, but the proposal from the peace advocates is always, let's cut some hundreds of billions of dollars out of the roughly trillion we spend on war preparations every year and invest it instead in green energy. But the response from most so-called mainstream environmental groups is always, get away, we need to wave our flags. And so I wonder, from your perspective, would it be advantageous or not to maybe spend less than 57% of discretionary spending on war and spend a little bit of that on green energy?
You know, David, I agree profoundly with everything that you've just said. The reason I'm pausing is that I think that, you know, even more than the, you know, immediate reduction in carbon emissions that the U.S. could effect if it slashed its military, and even more than the peace dividend and the solar dividend, if you will, that we could achieve by reallocating those expenditures, is that we, you know, and I say this now not as an expert, but just, you know, a citizen and a human being, you know, we are clearly a violent society, a broken society, you know, with millions of, you know, of damaged individuals. And I kind of hesitate to say this because I'm not trying to cast aspersions at the soldiers that we sent to Afghanistan and Iraq, you know, to fight these terrible wars of the past, you know, since 9/11. But we are bringing so much damage back here that, you know, clearly that is part of the fog and miasma and malaise that makes it so hard to achieve any kind of a national unity around the true threats to the United States and the world, which don't reside, you know, so much in so-called terrorism, you know, from outside, but rather from what we are doing to our common home, the Earth. So I guess I want to, you know, second what you said and then raise the further point, and I know this is in your heart as much as in mine, that by cutting down our whole military posture, as well as military investments, you know, that is a big part of the path to a society that can, that will have the ability to handle and address its ecological and climate problems.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and very good to hear you say it. I guess another source of funding for useful projects would, of course, be the carbon tax. And I guess there have been carbon tax bills in Congress. Is there any legislation afloat now, and does it do exactly what you'd like to see done?
Well, the answer is mostly no, but let me first say, and this may be seem a little heretical or, maybe confusing, that most of us carbon tax advocates, and that's us at the Carbon Tax Center, it's our allies at the Citizens Climate Lobby, which is far and away the most effective political action advocacy group out there, the Citizens Climate Lobby, and others, including Jim Hansen, that we're pretty vociferous about not wanting or even sort of opposing the allocation of carbon tax revenues to so-called solutions, or not so-called, such as mass transit and solar and wind investment. Rather, our society is so economically unequal that we've got to recycle those carbon tax revenues in ways that will make it possible for the poor and the middle class to be able to afford, daily life, even in the face of the higher energy prices that a carbon tax is designed to bring about. So rather, and as well, we are trying, and maybe this is a fool's errand, to appeal somewhat to the right wing in Congress and in this country by having our carbon tax be revenue neutral, to not increase the size of government, but to use, so-called price incentives as a way to, and the level playing field, to usher in the investment in solar and wind, and at the same time achieve the energy efficiency revolution, which is not just insulation and thermostats and better light bulbs, but things like redesigning our cities for biking and walking, smaller houses, and a general move away from a consumer-based society. There is, at the moment, no carbon tax bill making its way through Congress. And the cap-and-trade misadventure has taken a good half dozen years away from the push for a carbon tax. So maybe the shorthand is to say that we are regrouping and trying to develop a groundswell of interest and support for a revenue-neutral carbon tax throughout the country, and hopefully next Congress, in January 2015, there will be the political wherewithal to introduce a bill that we can get behind.
And those who want to help with that can find out more at carbontax.org. We've been speaking with the director of the Carbon Tax Center, Charles Komanoff. I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you very, very much, Charles, for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.